This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joe Cohen from Queens College.
I'm Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University.
And I'm Gabriel Rossman from An Endless Parade of Service Work.
We're on the web, theannexpodcast.com, on Twitter at SocAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Today we meet Alexis Santos, an assistant professor of human development and family studies at Penn State. Alexis's work became part of the national conversation a month or so ago with his and Jeffrey Howard's letter to the Journal of the American Medical Association, in which they argued that far more Puerto Ricans died as a result of Hurricane Maria than were suggested by official estimates. We got a lot to talk about: demography, Puerto Rico, public scholarship, and much more. You're not going to want to miss this. Okay, so have any of you heard of Andrew Arato? I hope I'm pronouncing it right. He's a political and social theorist at the New School. And he's recently been sanctioned for uncollegial and bullying behavior, reports the New York Times. Have you heard about this guy?
Yeah, well, he was actually a professor of mine. I have a master's in policy. And Dr. Arato is one of my professors. And I found him to be nothing but lovely in our exchanges.
Oh, so that's disappointing.
I was actually shocked.
Based on the pitch, I was hoping you like flinch when you hear his name or something.
No. So I was shocked, actually, when I read that story.
Well, you know what? That's to his credit then, because I mean, it's one thing to be tough on colleagues, but another to be tough on students. So if he's good to students, that's rehabs his image. Let me just read some excerpts, though. So apparently, Professor Arato, is it Arato? Arato?
Yeah, Arato, yeah.
Arato is being segregated from his colleagues for bullying behavior. Apparently, I'll read some excerpts. James E. Miller was a newly minted PhD presenting at his first academic conference when another scholar in his field thundered his disapproval, calling him a left-wing irrationalist for being sympathetic to Nietzsche. Quote, he was shouting and gesticulating as if I had committed murder in front of everyone, said Miller, who's now a professor of liberal arts studies and policies at the New School. I was not used to that level of intellectual fisticuffs. So the deal with this guy Arato is that, you know, we all have colleagues who are less diplomatic in their disagreement with us or their displeasure with our work. And apparently this guy takes it to a new level. You know, people said, you know, he shouted them down or he was very challenging, and they appealed to, they appealed to administration, and I guess they just couldn't get this guy to put a lid on it, and they've segregated him off from the rest of the rest of his colleagues. And this could be there's two ways to read this story. You can read it, you know, is this academic snowflakes, or is this the bully, you know, the bully finally got his just due? Do you feel like academics are a little bit sensitive? Or do you feel like this is the type of bullying behavior that we would need the administration to step in for?
Well, I mean, I haven't been his colleague, so I don't know how bad things actually were. I kind of feel that if the worst things that he's done are what were documented in that piece you're referencing, then, you know, I'd say it's a snowflake tale, right? But I mean, I have seen and actually been the target of much worse than that. And so, you know, and as a target of that kind of behavior, I actually do think that people need to understand that, you know, just because you get tenure and you get promoted to full doesn't mean that you're allowed to be an asshole to everyone else around you. I mean, you're really not that special. You
now,
know?
Leslie, before you talk about your own experience with bullying, I want to remind you that we're both bound by the terms of the NDA.
I know this, right? I never actually speak about it in real terms, just in hypothetical. So okay. Being like, hypothetically speaking, if this happened, would this be bullying? But yeah, no, I think, I mean, I do think it's a problem. It's not a problem in every department, but it's a problem in a lot of departments.
Bullying, you're saying. Be it bullying or snowflakedness or both?
I think both, right? I think both. And we need to be able to separate out the two. And like the perfect storm is when you have a ton of snowflakes and you have a huge bully, right? And you're like, oh God, I don't want to be in this department anymore.
May I say something about this first Earth step you mentioned?
Yes.
No, you left-wing irrationalist.
So, you know, I have sort of a very similar story as James Miller. Being a freshly minted PhD in 2015, I was presenting my first paper at a demography conference, and the discussant of the session I was presenting at, I think, or somebody who attended, started just like waving his finger, like saying, like, listen, young man. And it was something very, very similar to him telling me, you cannot project this number to be this number. Like, this is impossible. You cannot have this number there. Which prompted a lot of people to come after my talk and tell me, listen, later on when you're doing this, try to use Spain as a baseline. Mm-hmm. And, you know, down the road now, after a couple of years and the data to validate my estimates and projections are out, actually I was right. The number I had written down was the number that became the number, the official number, the official total fertility rate. So I felt like, oh my God, and I suffered that humiliation back in 2015. What do I do now?
It's probably something that we have to be careful about with early career colleagues, right? I mean, when you're just starting out, you feel very vulnerable. You feel like anybody you run into could sink your career. Or is it something like, I don't know. On the other hand, I mean, is it that awful to be called an irrationalist for viewing Nietzsche sympathetically? It seems like it's sort of within the rules of the game to criticize the ideas.
Well, here's the thing, Joe. I think that there's a difference between criticizing a thing and trying to shame someone, right? And in particular, when you're someone who's particularly vulnerable to the opinions of your peers, you know, i.e. those of us, you know, who either don't have tenure yet or who are up for promotion or you're a graduate student, et cetera, it's very damaging to have someone, and especially someone of stature in front of a crowd, you know, be that dismissive. And here's the thing. I think people who do that know that, and they do that on purpose. And I think that they target certain types of people on purpose. I mean, that's what a bully is, right?
Like it's an adult acting out and finding sort of somebody weak to punch on.
Yeah, right? Which like, so for me, like in thinking about the Arado case, like I don't, like it doesn't sound like he's a bully. It just sounds like, you know, he's kind of an asshole sometimes, right? And he doesn't have a filter. And it sounds like he gives it to everybody. He's like, I don't care if we're colleagues, I don't care if you're a newly minted PhD, I don't care if you're a dean, I'm just going to say whatever I want, right? I'm 74, right? I've lived a long life. I deserve this.
Well, we've all taken those like sexual harassment training. And then there's always the like little multiple choice thing to make sure you're paying attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's always the story where it's like, you know, so-and-so is an asshole to everybody, you know, is a Title IX violation. And then you're supposed to check. No, but yeah, I mean, you should probably be nicer, but it's not a violation.
So the American Association of University Professors, the article says, argues that we shouldn't use collegiality as a criterion for evaluating our peers. Is this something like, are we doing that with somebody like Arado? Should we be tolerating, you know, harsh criticism at any cost and putting the burden on people to, you know, as long as it's about the ideas, not be too sensitive? Or should we all be learning to be very restrained in our criticisms or maybe more restrained and collegial?
You know what? I kind of feel like this is mirroring the broader conversation that we're having in this country at this point in time, right? Mm-hmm. These calls for civility.
Oh, the civility thing, yeah.
Right? Which, you know, I'm just like, you know, okay, I guess civility, if we can't actually respect each other and listen to each other and treat each other like human beings, let's at least pretend that we do, right? I don't know how I feel about the whole civility discourse, but I kind of feel like this mirrors it as well. I actually think that calls for collegiality can very often mask trying to keep certain faculty members in their place, right? And trying to suppress, opinions among faculty that may not jibe, you know, with how the chair wants to go or how the majority of the faculty want to go. It's nice if everyone's nice to each other, but not at the expense of someone's real opinions. Now, do you need to yell and curse at people in order to get your opinions across? No. But I don't know. I also think that there's a huge difference between bullying, right? And people who aren't collegial, right? I mean, I think that one is much more serious than the other.
So this morning I read an Inside Higher Ed about a lawsuit there are a lawsuit against Georgia State about e-reserves. So e-reserves are those PDFs and those page scans that you distribute to your students through the library, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't have to go there and make a physical photocopy or share a book or buy the books. So three publishers, Oxford, Cambridge, and Sage, are suing Georgia State for copyright infringement over GSU's use of e-reserves in 2009. Now, the university changed its policies as soon as it was sued, but the publishers still went on with the lawsuit. And the case went to district court, and the university argued fair use. So for those of you who don't know, fair use is a principle that says you can share copyrighted information for the purposes of conveying a point or a lesson of your own. You can copy portions of a copyrighted text, but you can't copy and distribute copyrighted material in a way that's designed to help people get out of paying for it, basically. And the issue boils down to how much you can copy and distribute, right? How much is too much? So the publisher's alleged copyright infringement in 48 cases goes to court. Judge agrees in 4 of the 48. And then it goes to circuit court. Circuit court disagrees with the judge, sends it back, and it's sort of bouncing in between circuit court and district court. With district court supporting the university and the circuit court supporting the publishers. But the net effect of this is people are wondering where fair use stands. And this is becoming a bigger issue, right? As commercial enterprises try to swallow up more of the research process, put it behind paywall. So my question is do you think major publishers are helping or hurting the march of science in general and our ability, to deliver top quality education? Do you think they're helping or they're hurting when all's said and done?
Well,
and should we be doing it?
There's two separate issues. One is, do they have the right side of the lawsuit? And two, are they a positive force in academia?
All
right. And, much as it's often convenient or appealing to think that, you know, whatever you think is the right thing on the merits is also the right thing procedurally, it seems like that's not the case. It's pretty clear that the publishers have the right side of this lawsuit. You know, copying the entire text in order to recirculate it is not fair use. Fair use is more like a small portion for purpose of comment or parody.
Right.
So, you know, the classic example of fair use would be like, I quote a paragraph from someone's book in my own book in order to discuss their book, or I quote a passage from a book for a book review. It's fair use that I don't have to go to the publisher to get permission for that. But just copying an entire article and emailing you the PDF, even though it's something we do all the time, or especially putting it on the web, is not fair use.
Right.
Now, in terms of... you know, are they a positive force? No, it's they're fundamentally in the kind of rent extraction business. And I would fundamentally like to see academia switch to a new model where we get rid of a lot of the cost structure.
Mm.
And we also have things be more open.
Mm. Alexis or Leslie, any thoughts on publishers? Are they doing a good job? Is it something that we should look to get rid of?
I totally agree with everything that Gabriel just said, although at the same time, I mean, especially as someone who primarily teaches undergraduates at an institution where it's true the vast majority of our students come from very affluent families. Many of them don't. And, you know, you take, you know, the price of books and textbooks in particular, and you put that on top of rising tuition. I mean, I think that there are quite a few faculty out there who are very sympathetic to our students and the burden that many of them bear, they and their families bear, in trying to afford the things that we think they need to read for our classes, right? So on the one hand, I get it. You wrote it, you published it, you want to get paid for it. Mm-hmm. On the second hand, you know, maybe you shouldn't price those things so highly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. We have our great librarians here who every year make sure we understand how far we can go, mm-hmm. in terms of like what can and cannot be put on Canvas or Blackboard, you know, and not constitute copyright infringement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that, you know, those of us who are wanting to walk that line of, well, yeah, we want you to get paid, but number two, some of our students actually can't really afford to pay you. Mm-hmm. You know, we're walking that line. It's nice to have support at the university level to help us to make sure we don't cross that line.
Yeah, I have one comment, actually, about my own experience as a student at the University of Puerto Rico. Mm. That's not a research intensive university. It's more of a teaching place, but research is encouraged. And I can tell you that even when I was trying to do a GIS analysis, or later on when I did my master's thesis also in the University of Puerto Rico, paywalls really hurt me a lot. And I didn't know how to navigate not having access to papers. And at some point I paid $30 for a 2-page paper that I needed as a reference for my thesis. Goodness. And I did not even have a credit card, so I had to go and talk with an uncle that had one, who could had a Visa logo on his card, and he could help me. And I think there's an unspoken topic here about matters of access and how to navigate this informality in academia. Can I email the author? Will he be able to send me the article? How can I access this? And, you know, smaller universities, and even the University of Puerto Rico is part of the whole U.S. education system because it's a commonwealth or territory, but we do not have that much access to these resources. And I can only wonder how much this is affecting the scientific productivity of PhD students. Mm-hmm. And right now, with the economic crisis, the University of Puerto Rico is cutting a lot of money, and most of them are subscriptions to journals.
Right.
So, you know, it's kind of like shooting ourselves in the foot. And, you know, I don't know if publishers are actually doing any good by having these things paywalled, because it's work that we do and submit. And it's, you know, I think this is the never ending thing of, I did the work and now you're getting paid for it.
Well, mm-hmm. they do add value in some ways, right? So the typesetting is something that you get from the publishers. The copy editing is something you get from the publishers. Typically the managing editor, although not necessarily the editor, is paid by the publisher. Mm-hmm. You know, so those are actual added value. Now, on top of that, there's a variety of rent seeking efforts. You know, so basically sales people to negotiate rates with libraries is pure rent seeking. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to and then on top of that, there's also the fact that they give kickbacks to the disciplinary societies.
More to the point, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, particularly in ASA, you know, we very often have this kind of idea of we should do more expensive stuff, but somebody else should pay for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and when it comes to talking about our membership fees, we're like, well, why don't we do the AEA model of getting more money from the journals? And then when it comes to talking about, you know, open access and that sort of thing, we're like, oh, why are ASA journals paywalled? And I feel like you ultimately have to make decisions about these things. Now, my preference would be to have open access journals that don't make any money for the disciplinary society, and then the disciplinary society just does less stuff. But, you know, I'm acknowledging that there's a trade-off there. And I feel like if you're actually serious about really thinking that all the stuff the disciplinary society does, you have to be honest about either that it's worth either A, raising membership fees, or B, you know, blocking off access to journals to students at the University of Puerto Rico or whatever.
I wonder how much they ultimately provide when all is said and done. I mean, typesetting, you could get a WordPress theme for that. You know, I can
tell you, sociological science runs on a shoestring, mm-hmm. and it has some indirect subsidies, but the vast majority of our revenues come from author fees, which are about $500 per article.
Okay.
So now there's certain in-kind subsidies that we get from Stanford University and things like that. And we run it on an extremely tight wad basis. So, you know, we could charge $1,000 an article and we still wouldn't be making like a big profit. So I think it's fair to say that the cost structure for an article that looks like an article that doesn't just look like, you know, something that came straight out of LaTeX with the default settings is approximately $1,000 per article, maybe a little bit more.
Gee, but do we need it though? I mean, do we need all of this stuff? Like, how important are aesthetics ultimately? Like, is this type of, I mean, is this a, like, are we fixating on things that we used to care about, but now, I mean, they don't necessarily apply to, you know, they don't really apply to the quality of the knowledge or the advancement of science, like the attractiveness of the page layout or, you know, the gloss of the journal cover. I mean, we could easily be working on purely digital stuff and having a GarageBand style. Do you feel that would harm the credibility of the discipline or slow down the research project or have any other type of adverse effects?
Well, I don't know. I mean, sociological science actually considered making a print edition as an annual volume, and then we realized there was absolutely no interest in it. But, you know, people kind of see it as traditional to get ASR in paper. I don't know how many of them actually read it online, you know, in paper.
Yeah,
I read it online.
One thing though about, you know, typesetting, I don't know if you saw that thread that was a couple of months ago on Twitter about a fake edition of AJS, I think, or ASR.
No. what is it?
So it was this people who published with the cover of one of the major sociology journals. And it was a lot of papers that would not have made it there. And it was a really weird thing. And it on cover, it looked like it was a AJS article. And I can send you a link later so you can see it.
Yeah, please do.
But it had like a lot of things that were not AJS material that were just like, where did these papers came from? And they had like volume this, edition that. And it on cover, it looked like that. But then the typesetting was different.
Back in the late 90s, some Princeton grad student made a fake ASQ book review of Paul's hitchhiking book. And it was typeset exactly like it was an ASQ.
So I'm a baseball fan. And recently I was reading an article about how to promote the sport among African-American youth. I guess there's some view within baseball that, you know, they are falling behind in that demographic and they want to find a way to appeal to people. So anyhow, there is a former manager, Jerry Manuel, an African-American himself, who has an idea. And it's to have an African-American baseball team in the World Baseball Classic. So the World Baseball Classic is like an attempt to have an international baseball tournament. And this guy, Jerry Manuel, says, you want to get black kids interested in the game? Have an African-American team playing against anybody else.
So basically, when you're so woke, you recreate the Negro Leagues.
Yes, it's like it comes full circle, resegregation. Yeah. He even says it as such. He's like, just a little bit of segregation to spur engagement.
Well, you know, I kind of feel, you know, whatever. I think that's like a ridiculous argument, right? If you want to spur engagement among African-American youth, right, then what you need to do is you need to increase funding to after-school programming that focuses on baseball for African-American youth, right? You have to increase funding to like the police athletic leagues that are located in predominantly African-American neighborhoods, right? Mm-hmm. You need to make sure that the baseball diamonds that that are in neighborhoods that used to be predominantly African American aren't now all being used by private school kids who get to actually sign up to use those diamonds. And so the kids who live in the neighborhood and who are increasingly becoming displaced don't have access to the baseball diamonds anymore. I mean, that to me is, I think, the primary problem. I think we have a recruitment problem. I think we have a funding problem, right? And I think that's what it is more than anything else. I think people tend to look at it from the side of, oh, well, no one's going and trying to scout African-Americans anymore, right?
So, Leslie, I stopped listening after you said you weren't interested in the special league because all I hear is yet more of your Caribbean supremacy. You're trying to deny a safe space to, you know, African-Americans.
By the way, the,
and maintain Caribbean hegemony over the sport.
Alex Cora is from my hometown in Puerto Rico, so I'm really
happy. Nice. What's your view on this, Alexis? What do you think? Any views or not really?
I love baseball. Everybody should be able to play, like, integrated. We shouldn't be, you know, dividing people right now.
There was a little bit of an experiment with this that went on last year in the World Baseball Classic, and they had Team Israel, and which was just basically American Jews because nobody plays baseball in Israel. And it became in Brooklyn and Queens, where there are lots of religious Jews, and they played in Brooklyn. It caught on. They were happy. It was Team Israel, but it was really the Jews, you know, you just couldn't say it. And the problem was it was still the World Baseball Classic. Like, it's not, you know, it has to be good. You can't just pander to an ethnic group, I think, on its own. There has to be something legitimately special for people to gather around it. Like, Jews talk incessantly about Sandy Koufax or, you know, Euculus, but I don't think the World Baseball Classic is going to get that done.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see this as pandering. I mean, I see this as you know, this guy actually, I mean, he has a point. You know, baseball used to be a sport in which, you know, there were a lot of African Americans in the sport, right? Mm-hmm. And increasingly, like, the number of African Americans in the sport, at least, you know, in the majors, like, has declined significantly. And I think, as I said, part of the reason why that is, I mean, if you go into predominantly Black communities across the United States right now, you don't see that much baseball going on, right? You got to wonder why that is. I mean, so so there's a supply problem, right? And I don't know which came first, right? The lack of supply, you know, in youth, right, then turns into, you know, kind of lack of representation in the majors. Mm-hmm. Or is it just that, you know, baseball decided, you know what, we can scout great talent overseas and pay that great talent a lot less, right? Than
I don't think, know, that great talent's getting paid a lot less. I mean, how much does Yasiel Puig get?
They're unionized.
Yeah. Well, first of all, they're unionized, but
No, Gabriel, I actually think that initially that was a problem, right? I actually think that, you know, Major League Baseball would go overseas and scout talent, and the initial payment that they gave to that talent was actually significantly less than they would have been paying talent, you know, stateside. So, you know, that may not be the problem anymore, but, you know, sometimes these things are sort of path dependent, right? So we're used to scouting talent from this place, right? And it's done as good. It doesn't matter if over time, now we're still paying the same thing. You just get, you know, habits are hard to break and ideas about where you find talent are kind of hard to shake.
I think the real issue is that where you see a serious interest in baseball and scouting locations for baseball is places where the Marines have a history of landing. So the obvious solution is we just replicate that, right? I mean, you could send landing craft up to Bologna Creek, you know, come visit Crenshaw. Nobody gets shot. Just hand out some baseballs. And likewise, you can go up the Hudson River. You know, lots of the Potomac. There's lots of places that are conveniently accessible to water, and you could have the Marines spread interest in baseball.
I feel that's not a winner. All right.
Oh, actually, okay, so wait a minute. So number one on the African-Americans in baseball thing, I think the obvious thing is that there's just competition from other sports.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the Caribbean, you know, baseball is, you know, the number one or number two sport, whereas in...
It depends where.
Yeah, it depends where, but there's a lot of Caribbean countries where it's the number one or number two sport. Whereas in the United States, it's definitely the third sport. So, you know, there's competition for talent with basketball and football.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's...
Yeah. Well, I like baseball, so there.
Yeah.
It's an urban footprint thing too, right? Like, geez, I could see how basketball is killing everybody who lives in an urban area just because a half court takes up no space.
Yeah.
Like, you just put it on the side of a building and you can do it.
Yeah. I'm also wondering how much baseball is kind of like what we see with soccer here in the United States, right? So it used to be here in the U.S., like, you know, whatever, kids just played soccer, mm-hmm. right? And usually they were immigrants or the kids of immigrants, mm-hmm. right? And it wasn't a big thing. And then all of a sudden, you know, the middle class decided, oh, hey, this is a sport that we can get our kids into. Mm-hmm. And now it's pretty expensive, right? To get your kid to play in a soccer league, mm-hmm. right? I mean, all you need a field and a ball. That's basically all you really need, mm-hmm. right? But now it's becoming incredibly expensive. So this sport where in a lot of the rest of the world where soccer is or football is this sport that, you know, that can actually become a road towards upward mobility has now become this sort of avenue for middle class and above families to try and help ensure their kids have a sport to help get them into college, thus pricing out or making it impossible for less affluent kids to actually see this as a road towards mobility. Of course, soccer is not the money maker that baseball or basketball or football is. But and I'm thinking that, you know, it's also become a lot more expensive to get kids into playing baseball in this country.
Yeah. Also, on the matter of the Caribbean having baseball as the primary sport, that's exactly what has happened. Now playing baseball is so expensive that people are moving towards other sports. When I was in college, actually, we almost lost our baseball team at the university at the expense of creating a soccer team. Huh. And I don't know, I just sent you a link about this sport that people in Dominican Republic had to invent, where they pretty much play with broomsticks and bottle caps, because playing baseball was so expensive also for some areas of Dominican Republic that they needed to be creative in the way they approach the sport. So they just created a sport with things that they just had laying around that pretty much mirrors baseball. And that sport now is being used to train Dominican players to sharpen their skills. The New York Times covered it about a year ago. It was really interesting what's happening with sports in the Caribbean.
That's what it looked like when I was growing up in Brownsville. And even in Brooklyn, it was too expensive to play baseball back then.
So. Yeah, I have an older brother, and he was the only one who could play baseball because it was so expensive. And I just had to read on the on the while he played, I was just reading Harry Potter and stuff like that.
That's probably a higher expected return than sports. Anyways.
Oh yeah,
there's a bunch of academics who are sitting around chatting about whatnot.
Yeah. So before I introduce this next segment, I just want to say that I was away for 3 days in the Berkshires visiting my daughter. Mm. I did not read a newspaper. I did not go on my computer once. Mm. I did not try to read or listen to news. I was gone for 3 days and I came back and I felt like I stepped into the middle of a race war.
Yeah.
And that's basically what it felt like. It was like, okay, right. We got the shootings in Kentucky. We've got this massacre at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. And we've got no one actually really like accepting any responsibility for helping us get to this place. And when I say no one, I mean, you know, the people at the top, right, of our political establishment. And
St. Trump.
Yeah. Well, I don't say his name regularly.
Like Voldemort type of thing.
He who shall not be named. Right. And it is extremely disturbing. I was incredibly disturbed and I can't even believe that he decided to insert himself in Pittsburgh today by going in to quote unquote bring people together or offer condolences or help people heal. That is, to me, the most disgusting, the most disgusting and, you know, and blatantly political, selfish political move I think I've ever seen.
Okay. So I am not a fan of the man in any way at all, but I feel like that's grossly unfair. So first of all, this idea that he caused this,
I don't think he caused it. Well, correlation is not the same as causality.
Well, I don't think there's even a correlation. So it's definitely the case that he is both a product of and a cause of, you know, polarization and anger and cheapening of the discourse, right? He routinely says things that would have been, unending scandal for any other president, right? There's no president in living memory who would, you know, Nixon said that kind of stuff in private constantly, as did LBJ. But in public, no, you know, president in memory would, you know, talk about like, oh, you know, I guess that makes her into, you know, the bestiality, horse face, you know, all that kind of stuff.
So trading in blatant sort of hateful, overt hateful discourse.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, bleeding out your know what, your her you know what. You know, I mean, all that sort of business is something that no recent president would have said in public, although several of them would have said in private. So in that, but, you know, I don't think there's even the correlation there, right? Because this is not the first time that a Jewish target has been shot up. My little brother's daycare was shot up in 1999.
Whoa.
And, you know, and there was another terrorist attack a few months before that in Chicago, you know, and, you know, there's been a series of these things. And I don't think that you have, now you could say like, oh, well, those are isolated incidents. And what about the trend? And there's this famous ADL figure that's going around. The ADL figure includes...
ADL is anti-defamation.
Yeah, that's right. The ADL figure includes 123 bomb threats last year that were hoaxes by an Israeli teenager. So, you know, whether... You know, those obviously disturb people, but, you know, they're not meaning... I mean, and they created anti-Semitic terror, but it's weird to count a hoax as if it is part... You know, hoaxes are really the responsibility of the people who do them, not the people who they're mocking or imitating or whatever you're trying to, however you put it. So, you know, whether there's been a trend is highly debatable. And this kind of thing is not unprecedented. I mean, the only real difference between of this case and the cases that were, you know, over the last 20 years is this guy killed people instead of just injuring them. But, you know, there were quite a few people shot in Chicago and quite a few people shot in Los Angeles in 1999. In both cases, the people who were shot at the Jewish location were wounded. And then subsequently, the terrorist murdered an Asian American.
Yeah.
So here's
the thing, Gabriel, right? I mean, yes, I mean, terror happens like all the time, it seems like, right? And sometimes things have a cause, sometimes they don't. Sometimes you just have someone who has mental health issues, who also for some unknown reason has unlimited access to firearms, right? And that happens, right? But you know what? This like reminds me of, you know, the gubernatorial debate, right, in Florida, right, where, you know, Gillum and DeSantis are debating, and I'm totally going to mangle Gillum's words, but, you know, to paraphrase, he basically says, I'm not saying DeSantis is a racist, I'm saying racists think DeSantis is a racist. And I actually think that a lot of the things that our president says are taken as sort of like a pass for people to engage in blatantly racist, anti-Semitic behavior, right? And so I kind of feel like for you to say that they're not even correlated, I can't agree with that.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm just talking about the time trends, right? And I think that this idea that there was this huge jump in 2016, it relies on what I consider a coding error in the form of counting as anti-Semitic incidents, these bomb threats that were basically a hoax from an Israeli teenager.
Mm-hmm. I remember that, yeah.
Now, and then in the case of this specific guy, he was actually somebody who, you know, would have called Donald Trump a cuck, right? This is somebody who was on the far right and was disillusioned with Trump when he came to believe that Trump wasn't as far to the right as he wanted him to be. So, you know, I mean, how do you count that? I don't want to say that that's crazy because I think it actually cheapens terrorism to ascribe it to mental illness. Something like the Gabby Giffords shooter, that guy actually was a paranoid schizophrenic. Uh-huh. But this or Hamas bombing or something like that, those are, generally speaking, evil but sane and somewhat rational political action. And I think I would characterize this in the same way.
So it was big news in my community, and it's a sad event. Jews are reacting to it really, really strongly. And it's sad mostly to see kids being afraid of it. But you know what? It was sad when they shot up the black church in South Carolina. It was sad when they shot up the Sikh temple in Minnesota. They shot Christians. Remember that Oregon college shooting where the guy decided he would shoot Christians?
Well, I mean, the black church people were Christians too, so. Just saying.
No, you know what I mean. It was targeted. The criterion being used for who got shot was he would ask the victims, are they Christian or not?
Oh, God.
If he answered Christian, then he'd shoot them. And, you know, for me, I really don't want this to be inserted into politics in any way, just because I don't want anti-Semitism to be a partisan issue.
Well, that's my big. That's actually the thing that. So, for the most part, I thought people's reaction to this was pretty good, including the president. You know, kind of fulfilling his ceremonial role of being, you know, attempting to mourn on behalf of the nation. That doesn't bother me just because I don't like him. The aspect of, there were a couple things that bothered me about the response to this, although for the most part, you know, everyone had the appropriate reaction of this is horrible. But one thing I didn't like was this like petition from people saying that the president shouldn't visit because they disagree with his politics. And I see that as turning an attempt to turn anti-Semitism into a partisan issue, which I see as incredibly dangerous. I think that when somebody says this was a terrible thing that happened to y'all, you should accept their sympathy.
I mean,
it doesn't matter if you don't like them in other respects.
Yeah, so here's the thing, right? I mean, of course, I mean, there are people who are going to turn this into a political thing. But I actually think there were people who were mourning who just very, very, I mean, like politics aside, just felt as though this man's rhetoric was part of the problem. And because they thought he was part of the problem, they didn't want him to be in this space.
That wasn't right? The position of the rabbi himself. The rabbi himself basically said, he's the elected president. If he wants to come mourn with us, then, you know, that's his part of his office.
Yeah, that's the rabbi, right? Sure. You know what I mean? But that doesn't, he doesn't speak for the entire community, right? And so what I'm saying is I understand why some people didn't want him there, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I was listening to the head of the Jewish Defense League, and he basically was saying, look, you know, as our leader, you need to actually come out and actually say that you disavow all hate groups like this, right? And until you actually come out in this strong way, like we can't actually really believe that you support us, right? So I get that.
Yeah, I think if there was an incident where, let's say that in 5 years, some far left terrorist blows up an evangelical church and President Kamala Harris wants to go visit and pay respects on behalf of the nation. And then, you know, people in this red state town basically say, we don't want her here because she's pro-choice or something like that. I think that would be despicable. You know,
no, that's not the same as having a president who, number one, tried to claim moral equivalence between sort of the neo-Nazis in Charlotte and the protesters. That's a totally different scenario than saying, oh, you're pro-choice, so you can't be here. It's not as though Kamala Harris has said evangelicals are evil, right?
Well, also in defense of Leslie's side, I mean, to some level, they are trading in ethnic animus. That is part of the election strategy, right? Is spurring this stuff like the caravan and the Muslim invasion and all of these types of things. These do trade in stoking fears of of others, othering minorities and stoking fear about them. Like it is part of the strategy.
Yeah.
In all fairness.
And it's got nothing to do with tax cuts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, then just real quickly, the other thing that I didn't like in the response was, this business with having a Jew for Jesus as some type of thing. And a lot of people were upset with that. I think people went way too far in their denunciation of that. To me, that's just like tone deafness. Rather than like some type of like elaborate conspiracy that you saw some people talking about, but it still was a little creepy.
As a half Jew, and I guess Gabriel, you can appreciate this. Yeah. Like Jews way overestimate how much non-Jews know about them, and they just don't know. You got to give them a pass. But
hey, I will say that the Jews for Jesus would come around along with the Mormons in my like hyper segregated lower income neighborhood back in the 80s and 90s. So
yeah, it's definitely out there. They're definitely out there. And now we turn to Alexis Santos, an assistant professor of human development and family studies at Penn State. Alexis co-published The Use of Death Counts from Vital Statistics to Calculate Excess Deaths in Puerto Rico Following Hurricane Maria, a research letter published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. The letter was one of several estimates released over this summer that called into question past estimates of Hurricane Maria-related deaths. It received tremendous attention and became a point of political friction in the national conversation. It's a pleasure to have you join us, Alexis. Thank you for coming.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. Thanks for having me.
So for the benefit of our listeners who only know the broad contours of what happened in Puerto Rico, can you start off with a little background on Hurricane Maria? What happened in the hurricane and why do death counts matter so much?
Oh, sure. So back in September 20 last year, Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico, and one of the first things that hinted that this was going to be a hurricane like no other was that it tore apart the Doppler radar that is used to monitor weather.
Oh.
So just the first gust of wind destroyed the Doppler radar.
Wow.
And there was no climate information being pulled into the cloud that would be AccuWeather or Weather Channel. So down the road, you know, September 22, and even more days after, a lot of us couldn't reach our family members. And it really became a moment like no other, because my town is really close to San Juan. My mom is a nurse. And when I got a hold of my mom, who is a very strong person, and she never lets out her, you know, a lot of details in conversations, she couldn't stop talking about the devastation she saw, about the situations that she was seeing in the hospital, of people pretty much bringing bedridden patients and leaving them in the hospital, because if I keep my parent here, he or she is going to die for sure. So I'm just going to drop them off at the hospital and see if they can keep them alive. So a lot of the things I've heard, not only from my mom, but from first responders, hinted at me that this was a really big tragedy. Down the road, October 3rd, number 45 visits Puerto Rico, and he pretty much devalues and kind of dismisses the fact that this is a catastrophe and says this is not a hurricane like Katrina. And the governor tells him we only have 16 deaths certified. And that didn't sound to me as something that fit the reality. So I started looking at death records from past years to establish patterns. And once we got a hint of the information of what was happening in September and October, we produced estimates of excess deaths and we posted them in social archives. And then Vox picked it up. And then other media joined. And our numbers were pretty much the numbers that were coming out also of journalists who were doing a basic arithmetic calculations, you know, comparing to last year or comparing to 2 years ago. So, you know, having an academic institution like Penn State putting out a member of the community, I was at right there. I was in the Department of Sociology, and I was leading the Applied Demography program. It really boosted the attention because now demographers and academics are wading in on the conversation. And this was around, you know, at the end of November last year.
And how many, so you ran the reanalysis, the official count was how many again, 16?
16 certified on when the governor spoke with the president of the United States when he visited the island. And later on, they increased it to 64, okay. But that was still not enough. That was still a vast undercount of the excess deaths.
And what did your analysis conclude was the true death number? And can you give us sort of some brief technical details on how you did it really fast?
Yes. So what we did was we used 7 years worth of data from 2010 to 2016, and we built confidence intervals around the mean of number of deaths per month. And we pretty much did a comparison of what had happened after on September, October, November, December. And what we found was that there were about 1,100 deaths above historical level, you know, taking in consideration that we're not comparing with averages, we're comparing with the uppermost limit of a confidence interval. And that then the number 64 was pretty much 15 times lower than that it should have been.
No. And what was the follow-up? What happened? So Vox picked up so you posted a social archive, which I'm happy to underscore.
Yeah.
Vox picks it up. And then what happened?
We got a little bit of pushback from the Puerto Rico government. For one thing that was said by the lead politician who was leading who was dealing with the topic, the Department of Public Safety lead, he said he needs to give me a list of names of people he thinks died.
Oh my goodness!
And yeah, that was my reaction. I wish I could have laughed back then, but I said, "This is ridiculous. How can he expect me to have this information? I'm just doing simple arithmetical functions here. I don't have a roster of names."
Right.
That was sort of the way they pivoted. It was saying, hey, if you are saying it's 1,000, you need to give us the list of thousands. And then, of course, the social media became kind of a battleground because I was getting a lot of pushback from people who were saying, oh, you're just supporting fake news, blah, blah, blah. You're making the governor look bad and he's saving lives. So both from the political and the other spectrum, I was receiving a lot of pushback to the result, And, you know, I became a public scholar kind of by accident, if you can call it that. I just, the topic drove me to being open to talking with more people. And, you know, I started receiving calls in my office that I didn't know how to handle because, you know, I would get a call from a friend of mine who went with me to high school that I haven't spoken to in years. And she said, Alexis, my mom just died. And her death certificate says she died because of diabetes and she's not diabetic. She died because of the hurricane. So I had to deal with a lot of situations that I would dare say that I have a little bit of political training, but I was not ready for just such the pushback. And then came later on, I had a couple of emails that I received of people actually asking me for my data because they wanted to do their own projects.
Sure.
And you know, it's kind of like, I'm a junior scholar. Let me publish this, man. but yeah, journals, actually, the reason why I reached Social Archives was because a couple of colleagues from sociology here at Penn State had used Social Archives to share their papers. And because I had sent this for speed review in a couple of medical journals, and it was death rejected. And ultimately, we were able to later on run the numbers, and we were pretty much spot on with the analysis we did in November. But, you know, then also came some resistance because who is this young kid? You're not a physician to determine causes of death. And so it was just a difficult period. But, you know, I tried to stick to the science and see how things fared out.
So I have a question, right? I actually, like, when I first read your study, my first reaction was, why haven't we always been having both of these counts when we have these disasters in the first place? Like having, okay, these are the deaths that people say, these are the direct deaths related to the hurricane. And then also the number, right, estimating excess mortality that, you know, that may not have been the direct result of the hurricane. But, you know, but definitely you could say wouldn't have happened had the hurricane not occurred.
Yeah.
Why do we have both numbers?
Well, actually, the CDC guidelines to determining deaths related to the hurricane contemplate both. You know, it contemplates people who drown, people who fall from a roof, people who are killed because, you know, they get the flying debris hit them, and it also includes deaths that were caused because of deteriorating health conditions in the face of, for example, infrastructure-dependent people who need a machine for dialysis or who need a machine to breathe or to, you know, the CDC guidelines are very broad in how this is done. And that was the first thing I did was just check the CDC guidelines to see how they were. And I think the big issue here was when Katrina happened, there's this quote by the mayor of New Orleans saying, I think 10,000 persons died. Those were his first words. And that triggered a lot of responses. But when the president of the United States went to Puerto Rico, the governor told him, oh, nobody died, only 16. And so that, I think, was what triggered most of the interest in the topic. It was because the official narrative was not in line with reality.
How did your peers respond to you getting attention?
Actually, my peers were instrumental. During my time at the Department of Sociology and Criminology here at Penn State, I have really supportive colleagues who I can pretty much call friends, and they would, you know, come by, check in that I was doing well. They would say, like, how are you handling this? So they helped me a lot. I also, even though the paper was not peer reviewed by a journal, I can pretty much say that peers had read it before I posted it.
Sure.
And you know, I had like I was sharing a house with one of my colleagues last year, and we just went over to him. He was writing something. I said, like, can you read this and tell me if it makes sense? So it had some level of scrutiny by colleagues and friends, and you know, but the getting attention was difficult because I'm not trained for this.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it was a very positive experience. People were very happy.
Yeah, and another thing that that actually your piece made me think about was, you know, there seems to be, or there has been, a movement amongst medical sociologists and also demographers who are interested in mortality, in thinking about how death certificates and cause of death put down on death certificates, the ways in which maybe we should be rethinking the way in which these things are, or that final decision is made in the first place. There's this idea that there may be under or overcounts in terms of the cause of death of people from specific demographic groups, mostly because, you know, whoever it is that's signing the death certificate may say, well, you know, these people tend to die of this thing and you exhibit the symptoms. And so this is actually what we say the cause of death is, when in reality, it might not actually be the cause of death. And so I actually think that your piece actually opens up this much broader conversation about, you know, how do we number one count deaths? How do we figure out mortality rates? And how do we more objectively think about cause of death on our death certificates?
Yes, there's a big movement right now with people who are starting to study multiple causes of death.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a topic that I haven't gotten into myself. But, you know, the death certificate is what I've heard. I haven't been, I don't have the responsibility of filling one, right? But I've heard from physicians that it's a very complicated document to fill out. And it takes time. It takes about an hour to fill a certificate to its fullest. And following the hurricane, one of the big issues that I've identified in Puerto Rico, and later on the data supported it, was that they were not conducting autopsies on all the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So the determination of causes of death were exactly as you said. The physician said, oh, she had a fever and blah, blah, blah. So this was the cause. It was an infection. And the other thing was that when they were, that the processes were not being done the way they should have been done, because the physicians had to make the decision of spending 1 hour filling the death certificate or spending that hour providing care to another person who was still alive.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Totally.
So, it's emergency conditions do really pose a challenge in so many ways of logistics. But that doesn't mean that down the road, the appropriate filling of this certificate is not going to have any implications, because, for example, FEMA has a program where they reimburse people if their family members die because of the hurricane. If you don't have the check mark in the box in the death certificate that says that your family member died because of this, then it is going to be really an uphill battle to get that reimbursement.
So it seems like there's two issues here in terms of the resistance to your analysis. One is, you know, just like outright juking the stats type issue, like we often see in criminology. And then the other is that people just don't fundamentally get the idea of excess mortality. And because it's tricky, right? Because you can't necessarily allocate in any particular case what the excess mortality was caused by. So a simpler example would be, after 9/11, you know, all planes were grounded for a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a lot more highway miles driven, and there were a lot more highway fatalities. And I saw estimates, I don't know if they're true, but I saw estimates that almost as many people died from the excess highway mortality as died in 9/11 itself. But let's say that somebody died in a car accident on I-80 on September 15th, 2001. You can't necessarily say that that specific person and not the person who died on I-40 was, you know, killed by 9/11. Yeah. And it's something that's very hard for people to get their heads around.
Yeah. So, for example, one of the things that I've tried to do when I'm doing the numbers and crunching numbers here, have a couple of other analyses that I'm trying to get out soon, on kind of like how the past trends justify that 1,000-ish number, is that you look at, for example, you mentioned 9/11, but you would think that there's a couple of circumstances that you would find in the surrounding areas that could be directly linked to 9/11. For example, these first responders who were exposed to this termite and, you know, the other, they started developing the respiratory problems down the road or down, you know, after a couple of months. That's one case that you can make a link because they didn't have these problems before they acted as first responders and they were exposed to this situation, right? Say somebody who was in good health and because of all the stress they got, they had a heart attack. If you look at the CDC guidelines, those two deaths would actually be attributable to 9/11 because you can make a direct link between what would have happened if the event didn't happen. But, you know, driving the estimates of driving, I haven't seen them, so I wouldn't be able to comment more on it.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think we'd have to actually look closely at the methodology to establish what the number was. But I think in principle, everyone on this call would be comfortable with the idea that there was some greater than zero level of excess mortality because of flights diverted to roads. You know, now whether that excess mortality is 10 people or 4,000 people is something where we'd need to look closely at the math.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that why I started looking at this the way I was looking at it was because Puerto Rico, we don't have, or the people who are back in Puerto Rico, they don't have the ability to just jump in their cars and drive to Dominican Republic. Like they're locked in the island. And the days before the hurricane, the airports were not working that much. And because Hurricane Irma had sort of grazed the island and, you know, you have usual traffic. But I was trying to bring my mom to spend the hurricane time with me here. And the tickets were around $2,000, $3,000 when they normally go for $300. So it's a situation that causes a bottleneck situation where people are pretty much locked in the island. So that's why I said, you know, we can pretty much establish confidence intervals and we'll have a reasonable estimate of what happened. And right now, I think it's on the desk of the president right now, a bill approved by Congress to request that the Institute of Medicine creates guidelines on how to properly account for excess mortality. So I think this is a discussion that later on is going to be we're going to be still having this discussion in a couple of years, because it's going to be a two-year period till the Institute of Medicine has to come out with specific guidelines on how to do this.
Well, the one thing I wanted to ask, Alexis, was what's next?
What's next? Oh, yes. I am right now in the process of designing a study to study health deterioration. Because, of course, the dead people, we want them to rest in peace. But there are still people in Puerto Rico who are living without you know, what they call the blue tarps. They still don't have roofs in their houses. The money that has been assigned for aid has not made it to the people yet. And so there's still people who are living as if it was September 21, 2017 still. And that ultimately has has effects. It's added stress. What are we going to do? Probably my son left and moved to Florida. There's a couple of things that are happening that act as stressors to the population, particularly the adult and older adults. So I'm about to launch a study in a couple of weeks that is going to mirror my first study in Puerto Rico, which is going to be with online recruitment. And I got a couple of people who have 1 million followers on Facebook and Twitter to help me by doing promotions of the study and doing Facebook Lives. And it's pretty much going to be a survey asking people how they cope with disaster, how would they rate their health in the past, and how are they feeling right now to see if we see some health decline. And we also would and there's a couple of questions about stress, you know, levels of stress, and also how much in control they feel in their current situation compared to last year. So pretty much now I'm starting to focus on those who are still alive in Puerto Rico. because there's a couple of things coming down the pipeline that after 2020, the U.S. government is going to stop disbursing money to keep the healthcare system in Puerto Rico running. Right now, they're funding it at 100%. In 2020, they're going to stop that. And so we're going to be facing additional challenges that ultimately will affect the health of the population. And I want to get as much research on this topic as possible out so we're ready to start initiating policy discussions on this matter down the road.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. A special thank you to Alexis Santos of Penn State. Alexis recently published The Use of Death Counts from Vital Statistics to Calculate Excess Deaths in Puerto Rico Following Hurricane Maria in the Journal of the American Medical Association. We're on the web, theannexpodcast.com, on Twitter at SocAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. On behalf of Leslie Hinkson and Gabriel Rossman, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Yeah.